to come back and speak on aphids. And first thing I'll say, I'd like to thank Cotton Incorporated and particularly Ryan Kurtz for helping fund some regional projects in the Southeast from Virginia to Alabama. And I've got several co-authors listed there, but as we're learning more about cotton leaf roll dwarf virus, you know, as entomologists, I think it's our job to evaluate aphids and aphid control and see if we can impact the virus, and Alana has spoken on some of that. So my primary objective today is just to summarize basically some insecticide efficacy trials that we conducted in the Southeast, so we'll work through those. But just a little bit on just aphid biology. Sometimes I think we haven't thought about aphid biology like we probably should, because in most years we don't consider aphids to be a pest in the Southeast. And me personally, I probably haven't spent the time looking at aphids or studying aphids like I should have. But until now, I think the game has changed. But first and foremost, you have winged and wingless forms, and Alana talked to you about that this morning. But aphids feed on many, many host plants, both cultivated and weedy host plants. And so very broad host range. The other thing with aphids is they have what we call parthenogenic reproduction, and female aphids actually give birth to living young. That young aphid, which is birthed, is basically a clone of the mother. They have very high reproductive capacity. What I have on the slide here is one female can give birth to over 80 young, you know, 6 or 7 aphids a day for a week to 10 days. But because of this parthenogenic reproduction and this high reproductive capacity, aphids are very prone to develop resistance. Okay? All right, so this past year, we just spent a lot of time looking at aphids from the time cotton emerged, basically till just in the last couple weeks. But one statement I want to make, and when we think about aphids, we typically associate aphids building up in the latter part of June and then crashing in July. But aphids are present in cotton from the time cotton emerges until every leaf has been dropped from that plant. And when we think of aphids as a vector, you know, just a few aphids can be important. But if you look at this picture, this is some cotton that we planted late. This picture was taken 4 days after planting. I was just curious to see if I had a stand. This was a dry land field. We were in marginal moisture, but we got lucky and had a really good stand. But if you look closely at those two cotyledon plants, 4 days after planting, there's two aphids on one of them and a single aphid on the other. And it was over 50% of the plants, Alana, had aphids literally the day that cotton emerged. And I started thinking about that, and, you know, we kept watching this, but this is another picture. If you look at the picture on the right, I was putting a presentation together, and I was looking for the picture on the right and happened to stumble to the picture on the left. But aphids on seedling cotton is not that uncommon. And for the entomologists in the room, a lot of times we do whole plant dips to count thrips, right? It's not uncommon to see aphids. We actually did some aphid trials on seedling cotton, 1 and 2 leaf cotton, and counted them doing those whole plant dips. So aphids are there. That's 2 different years. And we just really hadn't thought about them as much, because unless you got down and looked, you wouldn't know aphids were on those plants. We're most accustomed to seeing aphids build up on squaring cotton, usually in the latter part of June in Georgia, the first part of July. As you go north up the East Coast, you know, the aphids will be a little later, but in the state of Georgia, they build up to high numbers in basically every field, and then we're going to see a fungus come in and cause those populations to crash. And as a field entomologist, once aphid populations crashed, we usually have forgot about aphids. But in reality, you can have aphids flare back up to detectable levels, such as shown in this picture in the latter part of August. But one of the things that I observed this year, and I think my colleagues in other states would agree, if you go out in the field looking for aphids, they're always there in August and September. They may be low levels, not a pest level from a feeding standpoint, but aphids are always present in cotton. And again, this time of year, it's not uncommon to see aphids on regrowth, basal regrowth in fields. All right, so a little bit on how we view aphids as a pest, a feeding pest. First and foremost, I'd say 100% of cotton in the state of Georgia is infested by aphids each year. Some other speakers talked about how they feed, feeding in the phloem. When we have severe infestations, and you've seen this, we can have situations where we get reduced growth from aphids and maybe yellowing of terminals. When you have sooty mold growing on the honeydew, that can interfere with photosynthesis. We do know they can impact yield. But in the state of Georgia, our research has never demonstrated a consistent yield response to controlling aphids. Now, we have some very effective aphid insecticides in terms of reducing plant stress associated with feeding, and that's carefully worded. But we can take stress from aphid feeding off a plant because we have very good insecticides. But for the most part in the state of Georgia, we spray very few aphids, but we do sometimes, but we wait on the fungus, which crashes the populations. And we really built this recommendation of not spraying aphids based on a lot of field trials. And when I first started working at University of Georgia in 1996, I was the first year BT cotton was commercialized. Wasn't a lot to do, so I looked at aphids. But over a span of about 10 years, we had conducted 27 different field trials looking at aphid control, and you can see the yields. And basically no difference in yield whether we sprayed aphids or didn't spray aphids. But here we are today, we're talking about cotton leaf roll dwarf virus, so we're revisiting aphids. And I think that's rightly so. All right, so as a group of southeastern entomologists, we kind of wanted just to throw a very broad net of potential insecticides and look for aphid control and potentially be observant for any impact we may have on disease or symptomatic plants. But this is a pretty long list. There's 14 different insecticides there. We primarily looked at maximum labeled rates. But we ended up having 6 locations throughout the southeast. Numbers in Virginia just never got to where they wanted them to be to really conduct a good field trial. So I'm just going to briefly go over... how much time do I got? You forgot to set the timer. 6 different trials across the sites. And these are basically just standard small plot trials, 4 to 8 rows, 30 to 50 feet long. We actually counted the number of aphids on the 4th main stem leaf below the terminal, and our objective was to do it at 4, 7, and 14 days after treatment. Now, one of the things I did for each location, I calculated a percent control where I could combine the data and give like an overall summary of performance in the southeast. This is the first one in Jay, Florida. And again, I'm not going to spend much time trying to dissect each individual trial. I think there's more to the message if we look at where I tried to attempted to combine the data in terms of percent control. But if you just look across there, the heights of the bars, we have a lot of differences in aphid counts. Now, aphid populations were not very high at this location. It's probably our least infested location in terms of numbers. Here's Dr. Jacobson's trial in Bruton, Alabama. Seeing our untreated plot on the left up to about 45 aphids per leaf. So that's a pretty good population. But if you just look across there, you can see products like Transform, for example, Carbene. There's some others there that have significantly reduced aphids, but I want to point out it did not eliminate aphids. okay? Whether you're at 3, 7, or 14, and that's what the three bars above each insecticide represent. But again, we've got some effective insecticides. Interestingly, this is in Tifton. I sprayed my trial a little earlier than other folks. We anticipate the fungus to come in sometime around the first week of July. So I was early with my sprays. But one of the things, we still saw some reduction at 14 days after planting. That's the light blue bar. But those populations really built behind my spray. But I was a little early with my spray, and there was a lot of migration coming into this field. Again, Dr. Jacobson talked about that window. So I sprayed on June 20th, and that was right at the front end of a lot of migration coming in behind these sprays, and we just didn't get great control there. This is Dr. Jeremy Green, who's in the audience. Jeremy gets the prize for probably having the most consistent and the highest level of control. So Dr. Green has a good applicator. Dr. Green was very aggressive and actually did two locations. But you can see most of the products did a pretty good job there. We had bifenthrin in there as Brigade. It did a good job of increasing aphids a little bit. Here's a second location Dr. Green had, but again, he had very good control with a lot of different aphid insecticides. This is Dominic Riesig up in North Carolina. Again, you can see we can reduce aphids with a lot of different products, but again, we cannot eliminate aphids. Now, this is just a summary of all six locations, and I've got three slides summarizing this, and what I'm illustrating there with the error bars is the actual range of percent control. For example, if we look at Brigade, the bar on the left, the mean percent control in aphids across those six trials was 18%. We had a range of a control of 0 up to maybe 40% with that product. But if you'll notice, the products on the far right, Transform, Savanto, Carbine, PQZ, Assail, those are the products we expected to perform the best. And, you know, we're 80, 90% control. And, again, Dr. Green had some excellent control, you know, 95, 98% control. But on average, you know, I believe if we can control 80 to 90% of a target insect in cotton, most entomologists are say that's probably okay. If we look at 7 days after treatment, you start to see these products break a little more. But again, those same products, Transform, Savanto, Carbine actually rose up a little bit. Carbine's got good residual activity. PQC, Assail, Safina, Bidrin's there. Bidrin's very erratic. Sometimes it looks pretty good. But those products on the far right that we expected to do a good job are providing the best control, and the variability in their performance tends to be less. Less variability compared to some other products. 14 days, the numbers get a lot jumbled because we had a lot of fungus interference coming into these trials, so the numbers were low. Now, a lot of this erratic behavior of these treatments, I think, is due to two things. And Dr. Jacobson has looked at resistance levels in Alabama. They've got problems with imidacloprid in terms of resistance. And also she showed you this talking about the time of dispersal. And I can tell you, at least in Tifton, Georgia, the last week of June and the first week of July, it's really tough to keep aphids at low levels. And a picture is 1,000 words. But this is some seedling cotton. I took this picture on July 1st, and I had sprayed that cotton on June 21st and June 27th. So that's 4 days after treatment, too, and look at all the aphids. But again, when you're in this window of some serious dispersal, I just want to emphasize the point that we cannot keep aphids out of a cotton field. Yield was optional in these trials, but Alana took yield in Bruton. There were no significant differences among her treatments. Jeremy took yield at Blackville at one of his locations. No significant differences in yield based on spray and aphids. And in Tifton, we had no significant yields, differences in yields. And I just want to reemphasize yields again. Between myself and my research colleague, Mike Taves, in Tifton, we took 9 different trials to yield. And what I'm illustrating here on the far right is the yields between what I call treated and untreated. Now, those treated yields could be, for example, my efficacy trial. I took the yield from every insecticide treatment in there and combined them to compare it to the untreated. I had other trials where I may have sprayed different products at different timings, or 2 sprays, 3 sprays, 4 sprays, but still no difference in yield from aphids as a feeding pest in the state of Georgia. Okay? Now, in any of these trials, none of the trials where we were doing aphid work included in this number did we see any disease associated with the virus. So we didn't see symptomatic plants. Another thing just to reemphasize, so this is showing aphid counts in a trial about the first, July 2nd. And in this particular trial, we initiated very aggressive aphid treatment using a high rate of acetamiprid at different times. We initiated 14 days after planting. For example, the bar on the left, the 30th of May, I initiated the first spray for aphids on the 30th of May, and I sprayed aphids each week for 5 weeks. The second bar I initiated a week later, so it had 4 sprays. But the point I want to make here, the orange bars were untreated when we took this data, and you can just say on average there were about 100 aphids in the untreated plots. We reduced aphids by about 90%, but the point here is you cannot eliminate aphids. So with that, we're going to continue some of this work and see where we go. But that's it.